You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hi, folks. A few quick announcements. We finally managed to acquire the domain kickassnews.com, so that's going to be the location of the new website. You'll still be able to reach us at the old address, though. But if you want to link to us or share the website with friends, be sure to use kickassnews.com. And the new listener email is going to be comments@kickassnews.com from now on. Also, I hope you'll do two things for me this week. Recommend Kick-Ass News to two of your friends and encourage them to listen and subscribe. I want to make a big push to grow our listenership over the next month, and with your help, we'll do that. Just share it with two of your friends. One more thing, if you're so inclined, support what I'm doing here by making a donation to GoFundMe.com/kickassnews. Thanks again for listening, and now enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass News. A couple of weeks ago, I did a two-parter on the future of artificial intelligence, and in part one, I talked with a fascinating man named Kevin Kelly. Today, I want to delve deeper beyond AI with Kevin and talk about his new book that's causing a lot of conversation called The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future. Kevin Kelly holds the title of Senior Maverick at Wired Magazine. He co-founded Wired in 1993 and served as executive editor for its first 7 years. Prior to starting Wired, Kelly was publisher and editor of the Whole Earth Review, a journal of unorthodox technical news. He co-founded the ongoing Hackers Conference and was involved with the launch of The Well, a pioneering online service started in 1985. He's written for The New York Times, Science Magazine, The Economist, Time, and The Wall Street Journal, among many other publications. His previous books have included bestsellers Out of Control, New Rules for the New Economy, Cool Tools, and What Technology Wants. On today's episode, Kevin Kelly lays out an optimistic view of the next 30 years and how technology will transform our lives, probably without us even noticing it. He says right now is the best time in history to invent something, and he has a simple formula for the next 10,000 startups. We talk about big trends like the shift from an ownership society to an access society, and how that means we may need to redefine the term socialism for the modern age. He'll talk about his initial skepticism of Wikipedia and his surprise when consumers began to take on the role of content creators and editors, and why it's time for us to rethink our intellectual property laws to keep up with this more collaborative dynamic. We talk about how virtual reality will open our eyes to whole other worlds and how we need to get over this Orwellian fear of data tracking. Plus, Kevin talks about his love-hate relationship with those pesky, nagging software updates. Coming up with Wired Magazine's Kevin Kelly in just a moment. Today I'm talking with Kevin Kelly. He is the co-founder of Wired Magazine. He served as executive editor at Wired for 7 years, and he now holds the title of Senior Maverick at Wired. He has a new book called The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future. Kevin Kelly, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, it's my privilege and pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You know, I've read so many dystopian books about the future in the past year that I suppose that I was a little wary of the title. But as it turns out, you have a fairly optimistic view of the future, don't you?
I have a very optimistic view of the future. And my optimism is rooted in history, because for at least the last 200 years, even longer, we've had a very steady incremental increase in things getting better, and but it's small. It's almost invisible. Each year, for instance, this year is a little tiny bit better than last year, but that little tiny betterment is kind of, you know, not seen very well because it's just, you know, a fraction of a percent. But a fraction of a percent compounded annually over centuries is what we get civilization, and that's where we have progress. It's possible that after 200 years of, you know, steady incremental betterment, that everything could collapse next year. But it's very, very unlikely. The probable statistical view is that it will continue at least for another 20 years or 30 years. So my deep optimism is rooted in deep history. And if you look at the evidence rather than the news, it's very, very clear that things are getting better and have been. And nobody in their right mind is going to take a one-way ticket into the past, particularly if you were only going to be assigned a berth randomly. You would never go into the past.
This incremental advance that you're talking about, I guess it's different than the days when we would go for long periods of sameness and then suddenly, you know, the television came about, or, you know, the mass production of cars or telephones, and then we made these radical leaps. With the incremental advances, is it possible that we may really be making huge advances, but we just don't even notice it at the time? We get so used to it.
The things that I'm talking about in my book have all already started. So there's really, I'm not saying things are going to be coming that aren't here now. I'm saying there are things that are here now, but maybe slightly dimmed, that are going to become major forces in our lives, like, say, artificial intelligence. In the next 5 to 10 to 15, 20, 25 years, these little trickles are going to become great tides lifting everything that they touch, and that means education, business, sports, food, fashion, the military, the whole thing. Alan Kay says technology is anything that was invented after you were born, and my friend Danny Hill says, well, a technology is anything that doesn't work yet. And as soon as it kind of works, you know, then we think of it as something that's important. Yeah. But in fact, VR is not new. It's been around. I experienced it in 1989, and it was very, very good. I thought it was going to take over. I was wrong. It was just way too expensive. Now that it's cheap, it's good enough to improve, and it'll seem miraculous, but you can trace its long life if you want, and you can see it now if you want. And I recommend that you see it now. And before you have an opinion about it, I recommend that you spend a number of hours in it.
And speaking of virtual reality, something that I found interesting in the book, you say that as information and access becomes ubiquitous, people will start to place a higher value on experiences like travel, going to live concerts and restaurants. But then you also say immersive environments and virtual reality may become preferable to real experiences because they can be manipulated to accommodate the user. So is there a progression that you see where we gravitate toward real-time, real-world experiences, and then gradually as technology with VR evolves, we begin to retreat back to our cocoons?
I don't think so. I see the general drift of technology as increasing choices and options. And if we examine our lives, it's really interesting. I live here in Pacifica, California, right along the beach, which is a surfer's beach. And when we moved here 25 years ago, there might be a dozen people out surfing a day. And now there are, like, on a weekends, hundreds of people. And it's all these people who spend their time behind the computers. And they, I wouldn't say they're compensating, but they are, they balance the time they spend on the screen with more time and more active immersion in their bodies and in the environment than before. And I it's because they are fortunate to have that choice. And I think when we will have choices in exploring virtual worlds, we will see a corresponding increase in the amount of travel around to the real world.
Really?
That when we make virtual tourism, will only increase real tourism, and that what we'll have is we'll increase the options in way in which we can travel. So we'll have the real thing. You'll have the bus tour. You'll have some virtual tour. You'll have something that's like, you know, mind transplant. I don't know what's all coming, but the thing is that we will increase those choices. And when you come back out of VR, almost everybody is sort of wowed by how good this simulation is here in real life. It's like, wow, they're doing a really great job. I can smell stuff. I can get little breezes. It's microclimates. And so I think we're going to see more choices.
Okay. So it's not the case where instead of wanting to go travel and to risk the chance that you might have a bad time or might not live up to your expectations, you can sort of preview it through VR and get a sense for whether you would enjoy going to Hawaii or going to Africa on a safari.
That is one option. That is certainly one option. Another option would be that you are going to go to worlds that you simply, or first of all, places that you could not even go to if you wanted to, like right. at the edge of a volcano or underwater. And then thirdly, you might go to places that are just completely imaginary, fantasy worlds. And fourthly, you might, actually go to a version of Hawaii that is, let's say you were in a wheelchair and now you're going to be able to run around or... Yeah. There'll be an alternative Hawaii. All those things are choices that you'll have. And in the final choices, you may be in Hawaii wearing some glasses that are going to show you, say, a version of Hawaii from the old time where you might see, or like, say you're in Rome and you're looking at these special VR mixed reality where you actually see the world as it was in the Roman time.
Yeah.
And so it's like the Pokemon version where you have the overlay of the virtual and the real.
Yeah.
And so my point is that you'll have all those choices and the old choices don't usually take away the new. Sometimes they diminish the value of the old, but usually the old sticks around. People are still going to the opera. They'll go. They'll be going to the opera in 100 years from now. Not that many, but that option will be there, and there'll be more ways to see the opera than ever before. There'll be video game concerts, and there'll be all kinds of new stuff as well that may be more at the center of the culture. But those who have a love for the opera will still be able to enjoy it.
Yeah, and central to much of the book is, I guess, this idea that we're going to have to really change our mindset in the next 30 years. I can think of several people, in fact, probably one or two, even in my own family, who are not going to be crazy about the first chapter of the book because you say that, you know, those of us who get tired of having to upgrade things constantly to keep up with technology are not going to be crazy about the future, because upgrading our technology and everything is, I think you say, it's going to be similar to hygiene. We have to do it, but it does make our lives better.
Yeah. So I was one of those people who was the last on the block to upgrade. And I'm on a Mac and I've been on Apple for a long time. And so I would just like, you know, I would skip, you know, these OS upgrades, and I would just do it at the last minute. And then what I discovered was doing it really, really late was really traumatic, because at that point I have to like nothing works. It's just like it's just too big of a jump. It's like a log jam that you finally burst open, and then it just completely wipes everything out. And that, as you know, as much of a hassle and nuisance as it is, that I would do a lot better to kind of go along with the flow and do those upgrades as they were kind of issued. And then, even though it was sort of a nuisance, it was less of a nuisance than this kind of major thing at the end. And of course, now they've wised up, or they've improved things. So a lot of those upgrades are done automatically while you sleep or whatever. They're a lot less painless.
Yeah.
And what that suggests is it's kind of like that it's like flossing. You just have to, you can either floss every night, or you can go to the dentist every 5 years and have your teeth yanked out. And I think we're seeing this, and it's not, of course, just your computer, because these days, you know, shock of all shocks, everything is got versions and it's got to upgrade. You know, like the hi-fi, the sound system, your car, the new Tesla has versions, and you get the new software or firmware in the car, and it's got new features. And so even though this mechanical aspect is happening, there's still the learning curve of dealing with whatever improvements that came along, whatever new features. You just have to get used to the fact that just to kind of stay in place, you need to keep moving. So even if you are not necessarily wanting to improve your experience or anything, you have no choice but to keep moving, because everything around you is changing. And so there is this sort of obligation to keep upgrading, to keep changing, to keep learning new stuff. And it can seem exhausting, but it doesn't have to. We really can turn it into, you know, like I say, like hygiene, into like a fitness, into where the more we do it, the better we get it, the less of a chore it becomes, and more it becomes of a habit, where our habit is that we're gonna learn something new in this month, some new gestures, some new commands, a new interface, you know, a new package, whatever it is. And it just becomes a habit, like, you know, eating healthy food or whatever it is, or doing exercise. It's just something that is part of our fitness, and we're going to become kind of technologically fit or technologically literate in a certain sense.
But I'm sure that you'll understand that I do kind of feel like I got sold a bill of goods, because it seems like, you know, they used to say digital technology was going to be unbreakable and it was going to last forever because it had no moving parts. And as it turns out, that's not quite the case, is it?
Right, right. No, it's not. That was certainly my vision of, you know, this is the digital age. This is like, you know, the perfect copy, the perfect thing. It'll be forever. And that's just absolutely not true. In fact, in some senses, the best way to really think about this stuff is less of it as a machine or something hard or physical, and more of like an ecosystem, like a rainforest or something, where everything is very squishy, everything is sort of elastic, everything is codependent and tentative in a certain sense, and where you kind of almost need a naturalist guide who understands all these indirect connections in order to go through and sort of it's like scouting through the rainforest, where you kind of use intuition and stuff rather than to treat these things as hard machines where you do A, you get B. No, it's kind of like, well, maybe A will happen, maybe B will happen, and I think if we treat our technology more like a living thing, I think we'll be able to manage it better.
And key to much of this is artificial intelligence. And I've been talking to a lot of people this past week about the future of AI. You say that you can pretty much predict the business plans of the next 10,000 startups. It's going to be take X and add AI. So talk about, I guess, some examples of everyday items that are ripe for cognification in the next 30 years.
Yeah, and by the word cognification, I mean to make things smarter. And I'm trying to avoid the term artificial intelligence because when we hear that,
it's
we
a
have
loaded a, term.
A lot of preconceptions. We imagine a human intelligence. And yeah. What I want to stress is that a lot of this artificial smartness is not human-like. That's one of the main reasons why we want it. It's because we want it in our car, driving our cars, because it's not going to be distracted like a human mind is. It's going to really focus on driving much better than a human. And the idea is, the second idea is that this kind of power, this artificial intelligence, this artificial smartness will become, or kind of already is becoming, a commodity, a utility, like electricity, mm-hmm. which we, in this first industrial revolution, brought to everybody, and you could suddenly take anything that was manual, and you could electrify it. You could make it into, you take a hand manual water pump and make it into an electric pump. And that was a source of both innovation, wealth, and convenience for people. And now we're doing something very, very similar, which is take anything that's electrified already, electric pump, and make a smart pump out of it. And you multiply that by a million times, and you get the second industrial revolution, which is about to happen. So let's take something like, you know, something as old-fashioned and boring as taxi cabs. We'll add AI, and you get Uber.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so just repeat that again and again. Take something that doesn't seem obvious, you know, toys. Add some AI, and you get these dolls that don't stop talking or whatever, and that kids will fall in love with. I mean, they yeah. will love these like they love a dog or a pet, and
yeah,
they will
that
be loved
was interesting
back.
To me. Yeah, they how you said that toys back. Will be like pets.
Yeah, I mean, because it turns out actually that programming with emotion is not difficult. We think, well, emotion is like. Intelligence is easy and adding emotions to these things is hard. No, it's the other way around. And emotion is actually very easy to program in. And these things will have programmed emotions, including things that we will read as love, as affection. And so, take something else. Take fashion. Add AI to fashion. Add AI to food. Add AI to furniture. It's endless. And this is a moment when all the easy things are available. It's like being back at the beginning of the internet when you could get any domain name you wanted, or you could take anything and bring it online. And, imagine, you know, in 30 years from now, people will look back at this time, 2016, they'll say, oh my gosh, I wish I could have been alive and young and full of ideas and energy and knowing what I know now, because everything was right there before them. This would have been the time, 2016, to start these things, because yeah. we're at the ground level. And so that's where we are right now. We're at the ground level of this second industrial revolution. It's like being present at the moment when electricity and motors were first coming. And you could think, what could I have done? Imagine what I could have done there. And so here we are. And it's not just AI. It's also virtual reality, which we kind of mentioned, and a bunch of other things as well, all right here, right now, at a moment when we've never had more and better tools and cheaper tools for anybody to participate. And so then, you know, this is, I repeat myself, but this is actually the best time in the world ever to make something happen, do something, create something, invent something, sell something. This is it. It's not going to get better than it is right now.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back to talk more with Wired Magazine's Kevin Kelly when we come back in just a moment. If you're enjoying today's episode, then you should read The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future, by my guest today, Kevin Kelly. And right now, you can download the audio version of his book for free with a special promotion just for our listeners from audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickassnews for a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download, which can be The Inevitable by Kevin Kelly or any of Audible's 180,000 titles. That's audibletrial.com/kickassnews, or click on the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And now, back to the show. One of the things that you talk about in the book as coming as something of a surprise to you is that you and probably many of your peers just a few years ago could not have predicted the role that consumers would take as editors and contributors and creators. And you talk particularly about being skeptical of Wikipedia and skeptical of the value of something that was edited and added to by the masses. But now you say it's a good template for the wikiization of so many other things out there. The Wikipedia model of the hive mind can be applied more broadly. Where are some of the areas that you can see this wikification or wikiization happening?
No, I mean, it's the thing about Wikipedia is that even though, given its success today, I don't know, it has 30 million articles or something just in English, I think, is that it's still, in theory, it shouldn't work. I mean, really, if you think about it, this is an encyclopedia that anybody in the world, some 12-year-old in Jakarta, can change anytime. And it's like, how could that possibly be reliable or informative? But here it is. So this is one of those things that's like completely impossible in theory, and it only works in practice. And I think there are the ways this has now become kind of an icon, kind of an archetype for other things is this idea that you can make something reliable by networking a lot of unreliable parts. So that individual contributor is sort of unreliable, but you can use the network and you can infuse it with certain kind of rules and logic and intelligence to make something as a system that is much more vibrant, robust, reliable, useful than the individual parts. And we see that kind of what I would call sharing, broadly sharing, not so much like sharing a toothpick, but more like a collaboration, a cooperation in things like crowdfunding, like Kickstarter, okay, where you're using this idea of the users, the consumers, the audience themselves is going to fund the thing that they want. You can see it in the way we have released now software incomplete in terms of beta. This is the idea that we're going to put out into the world software that doesn't really work at all or hardly works at all, and we're going to have the customers finish it for us. Mm-hmm. They're going to send back bug reports. They're going to work with it even though it doesn't work very well, and there are going to be co-creators in a certain sense with this thing. So they're now involved in actually kind of making it work. And we can see that broadly even further into all these other kinds of things where you have social action together, collaboration at a scale that was unimaginable before. And in a certain sense, even like Facebook with its 1.5 billion users, bigger than most countries, even though everybody's just sharing pictures and video clips and gossip, there is still a collaboration that's happening at a scale that was not possible before. And this is just the crude first version. But what we're going to be doing is actually using these tools and more, and VR as well as it becomes connected, to actually have millions of people collaborate to make something happen. And that is the power of this Wikipedia power that I'm talking about. It was not possible before, is now possible.
Now, what does this mean for intellectual property law?
Forget about that. It's
done. Huh?
It's so antiquated. My view is that the natural home of all ideas, whether it's any kind of an invention idea, whether you have a character that you've made or whatever it is, that the natural home of all ideas is in the commons, is shared, because there is almost nothing that we make that's a standalone idea. Everything requires a network of other ideas to make sense, to make the next obvious thing. You know, like an author is using words that everybody else uses. I mean, there's just so many ways in which every new thing is embedded and relies upon everything that's come before it. So my take is that the whatever the newest idea is, it belongs first in the commons to be shared. But we, you know, in societies, governments, give a temporary monopoly to that person who first is the person to come up with it, because in another 2 minutes, someone else will. Mm-hmm. Right? If that person doesn't come up with it, this is true in art as well as science, somebody else will, because it's the natural thing. But to encourage the thing to keep going, we'll give a temporary monopoly to the first person who claims it, but it has to be a very, very short period of time, and then it reverts back to the commons so that we can actually all use it. We give this appearance that this person owns it, but in fact they don't own it. There's this kind of they're giving a little license on it. It's not because they actually own it. It's because it is in the commons. Mm-hmm. We're giving it to them temporarily to make a monopoly, to encourage them to keep working. But if they didn't do it, someone else would discover it, would have it. That's why we have patent laws. But there is a sense to keep this thing going.
So, and then so do we the need problem to, is, are you advocating yeah. that we need to cut down the length of patents?
Yes. Patents and copyright especially. Right now there is this very weird thing in the U.S., that we have this copyright extension thing. So believe it or not, someone will invent a character or an author or something, and their copyright, which has been there to incent them to make new things, to keep working, mm-hmm. will continue for years and years after they're dead. There's no incentive. They're dead. There's no incentive at all. It's called the Mickey Mouse extension law, which is
right.
only there to make sure that Mickey Mouse does not go into the common right. The Commonwealth, and it's there just to protect Mickey Mouse and Disney, and it has nothing to do with the fact that Walt Disney died long ago. This character is now in the Commonwealth. Disney itself made all its fortune on public domain stories. All the fairy tales were all public domain. That's where they made their wealth. They were almost never able to come up with new stuff until they bought Pixar, and so the irony is that they're protecting and refusing to let Mickey Mouse go into the commons like all the other fairy tales where anybody can play with it and add it and develop it. And so we have this really weird thing where all kinds of copyrighted material should go into the public domains by now and revert back to the commons. It isn't. And that's a detriment to our commonwealth. And I think yeah. patents are the same thing. They should be much shorter, much more limited. And they're, you know, 7 years, 10 years is fine to incent people, but it's way beyond. We're still running an industrial age there.
And this kind of hints at another significant point you make in the book when you say that we are moving more toward a communal or socialist model. Now, those words have powerful and generally negative connotations in the 20th century, but in the 21st century, you say that I guess we need to redefine socialism and what that is. So what are Right. you talking about when you say socialism?
It's not just that they have a lot of cultural baggage in the last century, but they have a particular cultural baggage in the U.S. They don't have mm-hmm. as much cultural baggage other parts of the world. Problem for the language, for the term, is that we have this new, as I was describing before, this new platform of collaboration, cooperation, sharing, and we get a hint of that in the word social media. Mm-hmm. And so, all the terms that are surrounding this social type media are kind of corrupted by past politics. So collectivism, communitarianism, communism, communism, whatever it is, there's none that are really free from that. So I say, well, we'll just take the most obvious appropriate one and we'll just try to redefine it, which is socialism. And it's not an ism in the sense of an ideology. It's an ism in the sense that it's a general leaning. So it's a general category. And that is, we are more and more doing things at at a societal level as a group in ways that we couldn't do before. And they are both, we are interacting with more people than ever before. People think that we're somehow less connected or less social, that these devices make us hermits and recluses, but it's the complete opposite. We actually have more interaction with more people, and we even have more interactions with our own family than people say 50 years ago did. And this new interaction and the new dimensions in which we interact will have political fallout, in the sense that we now have the tools to govern ourselves, to make new things that are oftentimes neither a commercial product nor a nonprofit product. So we are engineering many, many new ways to cooperate, to govern, to engage with each other in a societal way. And I'm saying, well, the best word to call this is digital socialism. Mm-hmm. And it has nothing to do with the socialism that we normally associate as with the kind of a state overseeing it. This is a peer-to-peer version.
Yeah. And we hear that so many people seem to be resisting this trend toward tracking. You talk at length about it. But you seem to feel rather strongly, in fact, that the benefits of having everything connected and sending out data about us far outweighs the potential for some kind of nightmarish big brother controlling our lives scenario. What can you say to allay the fears of those people who want to be off the grid?
Yeah, well, let's start with the fact that just in the U.S. alone, there are probably at least two dozen ways in which every American is being routinely tracked.
Right.
From the little known fact that every piece of mail you put into the post office is being, the front and back of the envelope is being scanned. You know, I mean, they're scanning where you're sending it to and where you're sending it from. And the fact that in your car, if you have any kind of within the last 20 years, there's a little tiny chip in it that's recording your driving habits, when you brake, how fast you go, where you turn. And that's increasingly being sought after for insurance purposes, but it's being recorded no matter what. And not even to mention the fact that there's, you know, sensors in the road that's tracking your car as it goes across the highways and stuff, and license plate recording, and it goes on and on and on. There's all kinds of ways in which we are now being tracked. And then that's not even to mention the fact that we have self-tracking, something I started, the quantified self, where you wear a Fitbit like I'm doing right now, mm-hmm. and other devices that are tracking for you, your health or your productivity. And then there's the fact that our friends are tracking us when they take a picture of us at a party and they tag it on Facebook, which has a location, and there's no end. So what I'm saying is that just like copying can't be stopped on the internet. The internet's a copy machine, and anything that can possibly be copied is going to be copied and copied and copied. And you need to kind of work with that rather than against that. The same thing with tracking. That tracking is going to increase and increase over time, and particularly in the next 30 years, more and more lives will be tracked. And the question is really, that's inevitable. So the question is, how do we make it civilized? Because while it's inevitable that it will be tracked, it's not inevitable about what kind of tracking, whether it's something we like, whether it's going to be beneficial, whether we hold it accountable. Those are choices that we have and need to make, and will make a huge difference with us. And I advocate for something I call covalence, which I don't think is inevitable. I think it is a choice. And this is the idea that we want to have the tracking to be what I would call symmetrical, neutral, in a certain sense, maybe similar to the way we evolved over millions of years in the kind of a clan or tribe where we all knew everything about each other, but it was mutual. So while you were, you know, you knew everything about me, I knew everything about you. So this was something that we are comfortable with. And what we don't have right now is we don't have that symmetry. So what we have is we have they out there who are tracking me. And I don't know what they know. And I don't have any – they're not accountable to me for whether it's even accurate or – and I have no idea what they're doing with it. And I don't get any benefit from them. So that's the state that we find uncomfortable. But if we can do covalence where I am going to be watching the watcher, I'm going to hold them accountable. I can correct it and I know what's going on. And – I get some direct benefit for that. That begins to feel a little bit more like what we are used to, like in a small town or somewhere. And that becomes more civilized. And so I think that's the kind of choice that we have. I don't think we have a choice about how much tracking is going on, because the internet wants to track and it's just going to track. And VR, by the way, is going to become the biggest tracker of all. We do have a choice about whether it's covalent, whether we can hold them accountable, whether we institute, regulations about whether people do what they are going to say they're going to do with it, and whether we get direct benefits from it.
Looking at everything that you're looking at in the next 30 years,
is there
one thing that's most exciting to you?
So one of the things that I'm genuinely excited by is the fact that this technology and the old technologies, they already exist, are continuing to bring billions of people out of poverty. And that more and more people, as they move into cities, have more and more choices, and that it's more and more likely that we will continue to with these new technologies, make things that will enable more people to share their genius and their human potential. So I like to think about the fact that if you imagined Beethoven being born thousands of years before anyone had invented a piano or a symphony, what genius would have been lost? How our civilization and he would have lost so much. And of course, you can just repeat that with Hitchcock being born before there was the technology of cinema, and the loss that would be. So that means that today, somewhere in the world, there's a young girl who's been born, a genius, a Shakespeare of our time, who is lacking the right technology for her genius. And therefore, we have a kind of an obligation to keep inventing new things, so that in the hope that everybody born would have the right tools to share their genius. So I look forward in the next 30 years to more of those things being invented and more creativity than we've ever seen before and more people sharing more unbelievably great stuff, and us having access to it and it almost being free and all that abundance. That's what I'm looking forward to.
I really enjoyed the book. I found it both a relief and exciting, and I highly recommend it to anyone. Again, it's called The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future. Kevin Kelly, thanks for talking to me.
Hey, it was a real pleasure. Thanks for asking great questions.
Thanks again to Kevin Kelly for coming on the podcast. If you enjoyed today's show, then you can order Kevin Kelly's book, The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future, on Amazon. I'll include links in the show notes and on our website, and you can also download the audio version of his book for free through that special trial offer just for our listeners at audibletrial.com/kickassnews. You can keep up with Kevin Kelly on his website at kk.org. And follow him on Twitter at @Kevin2Kelly. Again, that's @Kevin2 and then Kelly. Be sure to subscribe to Kickass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. You can visit Kickass News on Facebook or follow us on Twitter @KAPolitics. And please be sure to recommend Kickass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/kickassnews. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.